Folks, you are listening to the sounds, the groovy sounds of the Countdown 5. You'll hear me tell Mac Hayes this same story, but it bears repeating because we get so many CDs at the station that they sort of all begin to kind of sound alike. You know, 60s band, only regional success, and a bunch of covers, a few originals, and they never broke through. End of story. They're, you know. And there's some charming things in that genre, but there's few that jump out like this one did to me. Just kind of the level of experimentation, and also on this new double CD release, you can really see the growth of this band. Also, they're from Texas, from a scene on the beach in Galveston that I just wasn't familiar with at all. And it turns out that really they started that scene out. So, super interesting story, and I love guests like this that listen to your question, answer them, and are polite and on time and prepared and have great memories. So shout out to Mac Hayes. Thank you. Check out his website. There's tons more to the story, tons more information, and he's been making music for 50 years. I didn't even get into his tenure with Liza, so check out those stories on his website. The Countdown 5, folks. Check WFMU.org/Michael. You'll see the list of upcoming guests. And enjoy this interview with Mac Hayes of the Countdown 5. George. All right, there is the Countdown 5 from this new release where we've been talking about the complete recordings, and Mac Hayes joins us on the telephone, a member of the Countdown 5. Good morning, Mac. How are you?
Good morning, Michael. I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You know, we get a lot of reissue CDs at the station, and there's always a few good tracks, or there's of some sort of historical value, or there, you know, it seems like there was a time in the 60s when you guys existed where there were just a million bands and they all made records, and, you know, 99% of them kind of faded. They were more of a live act than a recording act, and it seems like that is sort of the case for you guys, but so usually I listen to these CDs and they're not that interesting, but this one really caught my ear. There's you can really sort of see the evolution of the band, and the music you guys were making was very sophisticated. You must be very excited that the CD is out.
Oh, we've been flabbergasted by that, as a matter of fact. Come back 50 years later has been something extraordinary.
Yeah. So the original band, there was a band called D and the Dominoes, and I'll race through this part, formed in 1962. You joined pretty soon after that. There was some shuffling of members, and then soon the lineup was completed. And you guys played in the area of Texas, Galveston Beach. Tell me about what that area was like at that time in the mid-60s. Where is it in America, and who went to go see bands at that time?
Well, we really kind of started down on the Galveston Beach. Actually, it was just a little place that sold beer through a window, but they had a 8x10 concrete slab on the side, and we were all really kids at the time. This is about 63, I guess. And I convinced them that they'd let us play on that slab. They, on Saturday and Sunday afternoon, said, sell more beer. And they started doing that. And by the end of that summer, they had already started expanding the place. And by the next year, they hired us for the season from like March through September to play 6 nights a week and 2 afternoons. And they had, by that time, they had built an actual building that would hold around 300 or 400 people. And that kind of started a thing down on Galveston Beach that went on for, oh, a few decades. And it was the spot for all the college kids for the summer. And they came down from all over the country. And it was just an incredible place. When we started there, we were D and the Dominoes. And within the next year or two, we had, for other reasons, had changed the name to the Countdown 5. And that's where it stayed.
So was the name of this club the Bamboo Hut? Is that what we're talking about?
It's called the Bamboo Hut. We played there for something like 4 seasons or 5 seasons, and then one of our big fans out of that group decided he wanted his own place, and so he went next door and built a bigger spot called the Grass Menagerie and hired us over there, and we played there as the house band for about another two or three seasons.
So walk me through that, a typical busy day playing at the Hut or the Menagerie. There's a lot of college students. I assume they've been drinking. What time did you start? What time did you finish up? What were the sets? How long were the sets?
It was really a salute to youth, I'll tell you that, because we played six nights a week, 5 hours a night, and then afternoons, Saturday and Sunday afternoons included, and that was another 4 hours each time. And because it was down on the beach and it was open air, although it was covered, you know, big roof and all that, but it was open air, you had to set up and break down every night. So it was quite an ordeal in that respect.
Yeah.
But it was absolutely a madhouse. like I say, it was tons of kids. The Bamboo Hut originally would accommodate about 300 people or so. And then they built it up before we left, and it would accommodate something like 600 or 700 people. And then the Grass Menagerie would even accommodate more than that. And they would charge a cover charge towards the end of the time, and they would turn the crowd over maybe two or three times, and it would be packed, and it was a lot of drunk kids.
So there was a cover charge. How much money would you guys, would the band make on one of these 5 hour nights of playing or days of playing?
You know, I can't remember exactly what we made, but for the time, it was very good money. I think we were making something like $2 or $2.50 and a show, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was like eight performances a week, and back then that was really good money.
Yeah, I can. I can imagine for especially you're still living at home, right? And expenses are and free beer probably. This is none of my business, but I imagine lots of college ladies around that the band met a lot of friends that way.
I know nothing about that, Your Honor.
All right.
Yes, what? There were a lot of gals, and a lot of temptations in that regard. But the craziness of it all, I mean, every night and every day there was always some. And of course, there were a lot of drunken fights and stuff like that. And the stories could go on endlessly. Believe me. Actually, some of our biggest fans back then, I won't really mention names, but they later went on to become pillars of the Galveston community, very wealthy and all that sort of thing. And back then, they were, you know, running buddies of ours down there on the beach, and it was not unusual at all on a Friday and Saturday night for us to finish playing at 2 o'clock in the morning, and they'd hire us to pack everything up and go to one of their houses and play till 4 o'clock in the morning or 6
yeah.
o'clock.
That's funny. So the frat boys end up running the whole town 10 years later, 20 years later. So tell me, was the community supportive of this scene? I mean, it sounds like in, you know, similar scenes didn't last long because people just, you know, enough hosing down the throw up in the mornings. You know, people just couldn't deal with it, or the police called too many times. But it sounds like this lasted a while. How come?
It did last a while. I guess it's because they kept it somewhat under control. You know, when we started, it was right at the end of what they used to call Splash Day. And that was like, you know, the beaches in Florida and everything, where all the college kids would come. And that got way out of hand. And by the time we had played probably two seasons, I think maybe our second season at the Bamboo Hut, by midsummer, by the end of those Splash Days, which was like a two-week spring break type period, they had brought in the National Guard to shut down the beach, and then they ended Splash Days in terms of that spring break occasion. But the beachfront properties, and there was another place called the College Inn, and I think there was one more spot, but I can't remember the name of it. So there were three or four places down there doing that kind of business. And I know they lasted through the 70s and on into the 80s, I think.
So if folks, just to picture it, Galveston Beach, I believe, is sort of a little strip off of the coast. It's on the Gulf of Mexico, and it's not too far from Houston. And in fact, it's not even that far from, it's right on the border of Louisiana almost. So there's a lot of action that could
go to that area. Is it still a vacation spot now? I mean, is it still a beach spot?
Oh, yeah. It's had quite a rebirth since the early 80s. Galveston itself as a resort area had kind of gone into decline. You know, it was so big during the 50s with the Balinese Room and the illegal gambling and all that sort of thing that went on. That was a big time in Galveston with all the Bob Hope and all these people coming and performing. And then they cracked down on the gambling part of it. And except for the beachfront thing, the resort area itself began to sort of decline. And George Mitchell, the famous oil man from Galveston, decided to start picking it back up. And in the early 80s, he started pouring a lot of money into Galveston, building new hotels and nightclubs and restaurants and pushing the Mardi Gras again and all that sort of thing. And he really brought back a rebirth of Galveston, and it's flourishing now.
So take me back to when a band is playing to a bunch of partying teenagers for 5 hours. What percent, I assume you started as a cover and slowly started to add originals. That seems to be what a lot of bands do. Is that what you guys did?
Yes, we were strictly a cover band for the first 2 or 3 years, I guess, 3 or 4 years maybe even. And not only a cover band, but really we were kind of into the show thing, in terms of a lot of fooling around and dealing with the audience and doing even choreography and that sort of thing, medleys and a lot of up-tempo, high-energy stuff. And then we had a couple of things. We were able to procure a guy to manage us, so we brought in a manager, and that's where it kind of began to turn around and become more focused on trying to break out.
Well, let's talk about how did you pick covers? Would it be, a new song came on the radio and you guys would run to the store, buy a 45 and figure it out and add it to your show as soon as possible? I mean, how did you pick what songs to add cover-wise?
Well, actually, that's pretty much kind of a preference thing. And like I said, we were a high-energy rock and pop rock and roll band. We weren't blues and we weren't country and that sort of thing. We liked the high energy stuff, and playing down on the beach obviously was a big influence on that, because you didn't do many ballads down on the beach.
Yeah.
You had to keep everybody rocking and having a great time.
Yeah. So you get signed to do this TV show, weekly TV show called Impact, and I guess the producers want you to change your name, so you pick the Countdown 5. I assume TV was a big deal back then, and was this a show that all the young folks watched?
Yeah, we seemed to get a lot of good response off of it. It only lasted, I think, one season, so it was not enough to keep going. There was a local TV show in Houston called The Larry Kane Show that was a kind of a bandstand-type show, and that really dominated the airways down here. This show was designed to sort of mimic the Dick Clark show with Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Where the action is, I think?
Where the action is, yeah. This was kind of formatted after that. And the guy had seen us playing, the producer had seen us playing in Galveston, and we were kind of a Raiders-type band in our concept, with a high energy and Tom, fooling around and having a good time. And so he came up with that idea of doing the show called Impact that was all recorded in Galveston. We filmed it down there. We would go to different places in Galveston and, do cover songs and all this tomfoolery type, monkeys type Raider stuff.
Were you college age at this time, or were you still in high school?
When we first started, we were seniors in high school. And then right after that, into college.
Okay, so you guys started making records. In fact, one of the first records is sort of an ode to that club you mentioned earlier, the Bamboo Hut. And the early records, as you can hear on this new CD, are very garagey. But very quickly, the sound changes. And I mean, I would just assume that part of that is from playing so much, you guys got really good. Am I right that you, I mean, I don't know if you can judge this objectively, but were you guys really good?
We were really good together in terms of musicianship, especially there were three guys, three out of the five of us, that really progressed exponentially, and that was the drummer Tommy Williams and the bass player Tommy Murphy, which really became the bedrock of the band. And then John Bowser was our left-handed lead guitar player, and all of them sang. And Bowser was really a consummate musician. I mean, he was the real deal. And I was a singer, lead singer, front man. And then Stephen Long was our pianist or keyboard player and sax player. And Stephen and I filled out the group. But those three were really the just progressed incredibly musician-wise. And that showed up in the recordings.
So how many 45s did you guys make, and how did they sell at the time?
How many that were actually released? I want to say there were maybe four or five 45s, you know, two on each side, that were actually released during that time period. And I don't know that we got that many sales out of it, but we got a lot of exposure out of those records. There were two of them that actually charted on the Billboard 100, although I have not been able to find that either. But supposedly, I'd seen that back in the day.
That's interesting. Yeah, I've read that in your press information. Perhaps it's an exaggeration, perhaps not. I read that you guys were part owners of a recording studio, Andrus Productions. Why would a bunch of young men buy into a recording studio?
Well, that was the deal about when we got a manager. We signed up a manager who took control of our business, and that was one of the main things that we did that was so much different from virtually all the rock and roll bands back at that time, you know, local bands. And he really organized us, and this was when we decided that we needed to start writing our own music and recording if we were going to break out of just being a party band. And one of the ways to do that in our mind was to become involved in a studio. So we had met Walt Andrus, who was just an amazing guy, and we decided to buy into the company itself. And we did so, became stockholders in the company, then really put our heads together and started recording.
Ah, it's interesting. You guys were, because of your prowess and fame, became sort of the go-to opening act for bands that would come through. Can you remember some particularly amazing experiences of seeing acts who blew you guys away?
Yeah, we were the opening act for Paul Revere and the Raiders on the first time they ever came to Houston. It was actually a place called La Maison, and it was a teenage place, and it was actually an old grocery store that a guy had bought and cleared out and turned it into a teenage nightclub, and it would hold about 2,000 or 3,000 kids, I guess it was. And that was the first time they ever came to Houston, and we were the opening act for them, which was really exciting for us because we thought they were one of the hottest bands, and obviously we kind of patterned ourselves after them in terms of the theory of what we were trying to do. And we also opened, I know we got really excited one day, our manager came in and said, well, you're going to open for the Dave Clark Five. And the Dave Clark Five was second only to the Beatles in the world at that time. And so we were saying, great, where are we going, L.A., New York, where, overseas? And he said, no, actually, Nederland, Texas. And Nederland, Texas is a sleepy little town just outside of Beaumont, Texas, here, not too far from Houston. And we didn't even know there was a venue that would hold that kind of thing. But there was a venue there that would hold, I think, something like 5,000 people. And sure enough, it was Dave Clark Five we opened for them.
Were they good?
Yeah, they were great. They were great. And that kind of started us on that trend, first of all, of getting mobbed and all that sort of thing. You know, that was going on with all the Beatlemania, and we had not become accustomed to that. until we did the thing with the Dave Clark Five, and then kind of got mobbed and started seeing what that was about. But then our records had gotten played really down through the Gulf Coast, because we used to play from Texas to Mississippi, even into Alabama and that sort of thing, Louisiana, what we call the I-10 circuit. And we played a lot of the major colleges and that sort of thing. And that's how the promoters kind of picked up on us, especially being a showy band, to open for the national acts when they made their Gulf Coast swing. Because the kids mostly knew us almost as good as they did the national acts down in this part of the country because of our records.
Gotcha. You guys are from Texas, and although the recent election results show that Texas might be slowly changing, you know, it's a pretty conservative place. So were you universally liked and accepted? Because it seems like, you know, long hair and crazy outfits might not go over 100% in Texas. Am I right?
Oh, you're right. Yeah. Back then, whenever we had the long hair and that sort of look, that was still kind of sketchy. I know we had to be careful. We were on the road a lot and would, you know, like go into diners or something like that at 2 o'clock in the morning. You had to be very careful because we had more than our fair share of, you know, guys wanting to hassle us and that sort of thing. Mm. But that kind of evened out over time.
So why do you think that the band never broke on a national level? Because listening to these recordings, as I mentioned earlier, there's a new CD out called Complete Recordings 1965 to 69 on the Gear Fab label. And some of these records sound like hits to me, you know, in every way. The songs are good, the performances are good, the recordings are good, and just the kind of the palette, the sonic palette, sounds so much like what was on the radio then. What was missing?
That is the $64,000 question they used to say decades ago. And I'm not really sure. It's really that thing about, well, back whenever we were doing it, it was a 1 to 5 million in one shot, you know, taking it. Nowadays, it would have to be 100 million. But back then, it was really long odds. And I don't think very few people ever figured that out.
Yeah, it's not really a fair question. If you knew the answer, you would have made the hit record or you would have done that thing. You know, I had a guy, I had Carl from the Buckinghams on a few weeks ago, and I just for fun was looking at the charts on the week that they had number one with Kind of a Drag. And every song that, you know, was in the top 40 that week pretty much is kind of a classic song. You know, it was, the competition was so hard. It was, you know, the quality of music being made was amazing. But, yeah, sometimes I think it's just luck or it's who you bribed or, you know, there's just so many factors that went into it. Did you guys ever think we should move to Los Angeles or New York or, cause you guys were, I think you were that good. Did you ever think you should have done that?
Well, that was discussed, and that was the situation back then. You were expected to move to New York or to California and pretty much starve to death. In other words, go out there and live in some house, you know, all five of you plus other people trying to make a hit. And the odds really, you know, you go out there. We were more business inclined in that. That's all I can tell you. We, by the time we started the heavy recording and all that sort of thing, we were, I think all of us were married, and nearly all of us had at least one child. And we all grew up in blue-collar households with a certain work ethic and responsibility and, you know, in making your own way and that sort of ideal, which was not really a musician's thinking back in that time period, you know. Mm. And we were kind of different from everybody in that respect. We desperately were working very hard to try to, quote, make it, unquote. But we were unwilling to give up our families and just go to New York or L.A. and live out of a trash can and hope that somebody would finally see us, you know. Now, yeah. We did get a couple of good shots. Like I say, with our records, we got enough attention that I remember we, the guitar player and I were sent to L.A. because Anders Productions had gone into a deal with some people out there, a guy by the name of Don Altfeld, which was a promoter out there. He was also a songwriter. He wrote Little Old Lady from Pasadena for, what is it, Jan and Dean. Mm. He wrote several of their hits and that sort of thing. So he had a lot of connections. And he was really interested in our group and brought us out there and introduced us around and played the records, got in to play the records for some people. But it just never caught the big piece. I don't know if you remember a guy named Lou Adler.
Sure.
Lou Adler at that time was the one of the gods of the rock and roll recording field. Wherever he, you know, placed his hand, that's where you were blessed and you could make it. And I remember Altfeld really got us a meeting with him one morning, like 11:30 in the morning at his mansion in L.A. And this will give you an idea of what I'm trying to say. Is we got there, servant came to the door, let us in, said he'll be in a minute. Probably about 45 minutes or an hour went by, and finally Lou Adler walks in a bathrobe and his hair all tousled. Obviously, he had just drug himself out of bed and was obviously hung over real bad. And we, you know, Altfeld said, "Hey, this is Mac and this is John, and so-and-so got this record here." And he never acknowledged this or anything. He went over to the bar and poured himself a drink and said, "Yeah, put it over there on the bar. I'll get to it." That was the end of it.
Welcome to Showbiz. Yeah. Let me remind folks that Mac Hayes is our guest this morning and the band called The Countdown 5. This new record really, there's a lot going on it and really caught my attention. There's some early catchy kind of garage stuff on it. There is some stuff that, like I said, has that kind of Paul Revere sound or that kind of, you know, very 60s radio-friendly sound. There's some things, there's some covers, like a cover of Willie and the Hand Drive that I imagine you guys could just toss off in your sleep. There's some kind of fuzzy Beatles-y almost records. You could tell you guys were sort of experimenting in the studio and learning the studio. That's one of the things about listening to this record. You can sort of hear the sound progress. And then the second disc is almost all unreleased stuff. Why did this stuff never come out?
It just never got a chance to. A lot of it was done towards the end of Andrus Productions. You know, Andrus Productions eventually went under. And a lot of it was done towards the end of that, so there wasn't the actual energy and enthusiasm getting it out there to get released. And that was the thing that amazed me from Roger Maglio with Gear Fab Records whenever he contacted me back in the spring and said he had bought all the masters up. Well, we were part owners in the place, and we didn't know what happened to the masters. And so that, I don't know how the heck he got a hold of them 50 years later, but that was pretty extraordinary. Now, we do know, because two of the songs on there that were our biggest songs, Uncle Kirby from Brazil and Shake a Nana, those two I found out in the 90s when I first put up my website. I found out that those two records had been put on compilation albums in Europe in the 70s. I started getting, they were on my website, obviously, as part of my bio, and I started getting emails from people in Europe, Spain, France, England, saying, "Oh yeah, we remember those songs. We used to dance to them in the discos in the 70s in Europe, and we never knew that." As a matter of fact, somebody emailed me a Billboard Top 100 German chart, and for like a 2-week period of time or something, Shake a Nana was number one in Germany in 1968. So
that's
go
crazy.
Figure.
Yeah, that's very unusual that he was able to buy the masters. I mean, do you think that that somehow there's something a little screwy with that?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think there's anything screwy on Roger Maglio's part. I mean, he's got a long career. He's been doing this since the 80s, and he's very, believe me, I checked him out before we ever signed, you know, publishing contract with him.
But did you guys feel that you owned that you already owned them, you know, that they were someone else's to sell?
Right, we certainly thought we owned part of them, as part of the business. But let me tell you, you know, in the 60s, that was pretty much standard operating procedure. Nobody really got the money they were supposed to get in the 60s in the bands, and that includes the Beatles, the Stones, and then when you go down to our level, you can see there was just no way, nothing.
Yeah. Well, I've heard that story a million times. So in 1969, the band disbanded. Why?
It had just kind of run its normal course. By that time, we were, I think, running out of ideas and energy. We were just simply playing to make a living, and which was okay. That's what we all wanted to do, is make a living as musicians, and which was very unusual, too, to be able to do at that time. And we were succeeding in that. But it just got to a point where, well, actually, what had happened is one of the guys decided, Tommy Murphy, the bass player, decided that he wanted to get out of the music business and do something else. And then, almost within a matter of months of that, we had an offer to go with Liza Minnelli to work. And so there were three of us still together at that time of the original five. And so the three of us signed up to go with her with this guy that was from another band that was with her at the time, and to form a group called the Wire Band.
It's such an interesting story, and it's hard to believe that these recordings are 50 years old. Some of them sound so fresh. So you did tour with Liza for a few years, and there's some interesting stories how you made some music for the Astros and the Houston Oilers. Folks can read about it on your – some huge records connected to those two teams on your website, which I believe is machaze.com. And you're still playing. I mean, you owned a club, but you've been playing this whole 50 years, and you're still playing today. And I know that everyone in the band is still alive, right? Are they all still friends?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Three of us, myself, Tommy Williams, and Tommy Murphy, pretty much grew up together from about the sixth grade on, so we were longtime buddies. And then when we brought Steve and John into the band, then it became like family, and it's pretty much been that way ever since.
That's very sweet.
Even though the band disbanded back in 69, we've all remained close friends.
Well, Mac Hayes, I think, folks, am I right? They can still see you Friday and Saturday nights at the Sundance Grill 2 in Kema, Texas. Is that right?
Kema, Texas, yeah.
Kema, mm-hmm. Texas. And what's your set like these days? Are you still doing songs that you did 50 years ago?
That's the irony of it all. That has been the most lasting music of any that I know of. I do, of course, I do a variety of things. I do, obviously, a lot of classic rock, a lot of pop music, but I do some Sinatra stuff, you know, easy listening, that some country, a little bit of everything like that, but it's all pre-80s, you know.
Gotcha.
I don't do hardly anything from the late 80s on.
Gotcha. Like I said, there's more information about all of this, including the CD, over at machaze.com. I want to play Don't Buy Meat from the Milkman, maybe my favorite track on this CD. It's one of the previously unreleased ones. It's very kind of Kinks sounding to me. It's very sophisticatedly recorded and arranged. Do you remember recording this? I mean, do you remember how long it took? Do you remember, I don't know who wrote the song, where did it come from? And are you a fan of it?
Oh yeah, I'm a fan of it. You're going to catch me on this because I can't remember. We had to sit down and work on this before the publishing company before we signed with the publishing, as to who wrote what. I think that was written by three of us, but the idea was that, you know, it was back then you tried to use all this weird phrasing and everything to say what you wanted to say. And of course, that was like, if you're going to get information, go to the right place. Don't buy it from the wrong place. That was essentially what it was about. And it none of it really took so long to record. Our recording sessions were tended to be pretty extensive, but since we had part ownership, we had pretty much free reign of the place. And that, thanks to Walt, you're talking about us learning in this curve, and he is who accelerated that. And also, John Bowser, our guitar player, became an excellent engineer, and he was very good in the studio, period. And a lot of that was a big help, but we did take our time in the studio and work on it, but we did a lot of partying in the studio too. I mean, you can tell by Shaking Na Na and a couple of the other songs like that, were, we must have had 30 or 40 people in the studio that were doing crowds.
Well, I think this song is a total number one hit record. Let's hear it now. And Matt Hayes, thanks for spending this Saturday morning with us. I really, just what a great story and just, you know, great music.
Michael, I thank you very much. We're excited about this, and it's been just a heck of a lot of fun.
Sunrise finds him standing there, knocking on your door. Place your orders as prescribed, just his daily chore. Bow tie, white shirt, pants on press, sunshine trims his pail. Phrase may catch you unaware, run to mama, run to papa too. Jason's brother cannot help you.
Underbargain needlessly, milkman says his land.
Meats are not his specialty. Run to mama, run to papa too. Jason's brother cannot help you. Buy his sweet milk, try his curdle too. Not the ribeyes, he will cheat you. Mama, run to papa too. Jason's brother cannot help you. Buy his sweet milk, try his curdle too. Not the ribeyes, he will cheat you.